today, now that we finally have a public inquiry into the undercover policing of activists, we look back at the Guardian investigation that broke open the Spy Cop scandal. For many years, The Guardian's Rob Evans and Paul Lewis have been digging into the practice of the police going undercover to spy on activists. For Paul, there's one scene that he keeps coming back to. A group of officers were drinking together, sitting on worn sofas in a London apartment that they used as a safe house.
At one of these meetings in the early 90s, shortly after the Berlin Wall came down, they had the TV on and there was a news report about the Stasi in Germany.
At Communist Party headquarters, a multicoloured wall painting has replaced the drab Stalinist slogans which adorned the facade under Honecker. Yeah. As investigators and citizens' committees continue their dig through the enormous apparatus of the Stasi secret police...
People were going along and getting hold of their personal files to find out the information that the Stasi had got on them and were discovering the people who had been informing on them, you know, friends were snooping on them, lovers and partners were spying on one another.
Preliminary analysis of the massive Stasi security records held on computers and in files is beginning to reveal the true web of agents and informers.
Regular, everyday people who were shocked to discover that people who they thought were friends and lovers had informed on them. According to someone who was in that safe house, the police officers looked at each other and started saying to one another, this could be us one day.
It would be more than 15 years before Paul and Rob would receive a tip-off that would result in them working with activists to unravel a web of secrets and lies that would unveil duplicitous relationships, stolen identities, and result in a major public inquiry.
The 40-year surveillance operation on political activists was probably the biggest secret in modern policing history.
Over the next two episodes, we will take you into the heart of their extraordinary 10-year investigation. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the Spy Cop scandal, part one. Jessica, this story starts in 1992. Tell me about what you were doing back then.
I moved up to London and was living in a house with lots of animal rights friends. And we would do things like leaflets outside shops that tested on animals and places that sold fur and circus demos. And also, I was a hunt saboteur.
What's a hunt saboteur? What did you do?
We used to go out and sort of follow the hunt and like spray over the where the fox had been to confuse the hounds.
Would you be on horses?
No, no. It was quite a long day's exercise. No, we used to follow them on foot.
You were really passionate about it then. Did you enjoy that period of time?
I won't say I enjoyed it per se. I mean, certainly not the hunt saboteuring. You know, it's horrible because, you know, the last thing you want them to do is to kill anything, you know, or any of the horses to be hurt. And so, no, it wasn't. You know, it was good at the end of the day if the hunt hadn't killed. But it was just nice to be around people that felt exactly the same way.
How would you have described yourself at the time?
I think I sort of pretended to be sort of quite confident when actually that was sort of the furthest thing from the truth. I didn't get close to people very much. You know, I'd had sort of like quite a difficult childhood and had been sort of bullied quite a lot when I was at school. And so I think that's probably why I prefer animals to people. It's one of those things, you know, I mean, kids will find anything to bully you about.
Tell me about the man you knew as Andy Davey. Can you remember the first time you met him? What was he like?
I don't actually remember the first time that I met him, you know, he was just there. He used to be at pickets, and he used to be sabbing, and would see him at various demonstrations. And, you know, he wasn't anyone that you would particularly have noticed. Probably the first time that I remember sort of really actually having anything particularly to do with him is when he used to come round our house, like late in the evenings, and then he would be quite difficult to get rid of. It got to the point where myself and the other people in the house had said, you know, well, I didn't invite him round, you know, you must have done. And everybody said, I didn't, I thought you did. And then we sort of realised, actually, no, he'd invited himself. None of us had asked him round. One particular time he was round and we were watching the TV. I turned to him either to speak to him or he'd spoken to me. And he just, you know, no sort of no warning, no nothing. He just kissed me. He just like leant over and just kissed me. And it was just, it was so excruciatingly awkward that I just didn't really know what to do. You know, I mean, I hadn't had a proper boyfriend before. And so I was really, you know, it was very naive, very inexperienced and, you know, very low self-confidence and quite just awkward. You know, it was awkward. That's how I remember.
What did you do?
I kissed him back. I didn't make a scene. I didn't sort of like pull away and that, because there was also like a part of me that wouldn't want to hurt his feelings. You kind of felt a little bit sorry for him. Like he's, you know, he wasn't really sort of like socially great. And I just think, you know, that would have been awful if I'd have sort of gone, ugh, get off and, you know, wipe my face. It would have been nasty. And I couldn't do that.
What did you think afterwards and how did things develop?
We seemed to be in a relationship, you know, without actually ever saying sort of the words. But, you know, he used to come round and he used to stay over. And, you know, and eventually then, you know, sort of it was a sexual relationship.
So it seemed like he sought you out. You fell into a relationship with him. It sounds like you weren't sure about it. Did it become a proper relationship? Did he meet your parents, for example? Would you have called him your boyfriend?
Yes, I mean, the people that I lived in the house with, they knew that he was, you know, that we were together and that, because he used to stay over, obviously used to stay over in my room. And my parents sort of knew because I came home a few times and he came with me.
What did he tell you about the rest of his life?
Not a great deal. I don't really remember being particularly interested in, you know, finding out. I didn't want to know everything about him. He did come to my parents' house when I was abroad. He came to my parents' house with a friend of mine, and he had a conversation with my parents. He sent my friend down the garden, had a conversation with my parents. And then on the way back to London, he was saying to my friend, you know, my parents were really pleased that he and I were together, what with both of us being adopted. I was adopted as a baby. And I was bullied as a child because of it. And that made me hugely ashamed of it. So I didn't used to tell anybody, and it was, you know, for all of my life it's been, you know, a real issue.
So you were close enough that he was visiting your parents without you. I mean, how do you think of that relationship? I know it's a long time ago. Did you think you were in love?
No, I never loved him. I suppose I was fond of him. You know, he was a nice enough person. You know, he, you know, his heart seemed to be in the right place. And, you know, he wasn't nasty. He wasn't violent. I thought he was, you know, at the very least a decent man.
How did the relationship come to an end? When was the last time you saw him?
It would have been, I suppose, summer 93. I got to know someone else. It just highlighted all the things that were wrong with my relationship with him. There's somebody that actually, you know, there is a spark there with. And so I finished it with Andy and just sort of said, you know, like, you know, there's someone else that I like and it's not right. You know, it just isn't right with us. And he was fine about it. I heard that, so it must have been in 95, that he was leaving the UK to go to the Czech Republic, was where I heard he was going, to teach English. And that was sort of the last that I ever heard of him. No one, you know, as far as I was concerned, nobody seemed to hear of him after that. And he sort of passed out of memory. That was until he came back into my life in February 2017. It was around 11 o'clock and I got a message pop up, a friend request from somebody that I used to know back in 91, 92. He said, oh, have you heard all about the spy cops? And I have to say that was the first time that I ever heard the word. And I said, I don't really know what you mean. And he said, well, you know, there were undercover police in our groups. He forwarded me to a page. And then all of a sudden there was a picture of Andy. And I just remember sort of sitting there and just, you know, I couldn't sort of say anything or, and I said, oh my God, you know, there was that whole sort of just shock, just complete shock.
Twenty 2017 may have been the first time that Jessica had ever heard the term spy cops, but the outing of Andy Coles was in fact part of a much bigger story that had started to unfold 8 years earlier in the Guardian newsroom with reporters Rob Evans and Paul Lewis.
I think around 2009, we were getting really interested in the policing of protest. You know, we had revealed that Ian Tomlinson had been killed by a police officer at the G20 protest.
For around 10 seconds, Tomlinson seems to be talking to the officers. They do not help him. Witnesses described seeing him dazed and stumbling along the road before he collapsed.
That had thrown up a lot more leads, and lots of people on the protest side were getting in touch with us with concerns about how protests were being policed and how activism generally was being treated by the state. The thing that kind of got us interested in the notion of surveillance was these things called forward intelligence teams. And they were basically groups of maybe three or four police officers who would wear high visibility jackets and very conspicuously walk around protests with cameras, basically telling activists that they were following them. And you know, this wasn't in any way covert. In fact, it was the opposite.
So don't be blocking people. Feel
nobody,
free to move along the line.
Nobody's been blocking.
Right, well, I'll be watching you, OK?
I'll be watching you, officer.
I think the message, the intention was to say, you know, we're watching you. And gradually, we started to hear some stories about the possibility that there might be long-term undercover police officers living as if they were activists for years at a time.
And Rob, where did that lead you?
The first inkling that we had was, funnily enough, this posting on Indymedia, which was an activist website.
Which was basically like an anarchic blank canvas that many people in activism would use to anonymously post information. And on the 24th of October in 2010, there was a post, and it said, Mark Kennedy, a.k.a. Mark Stone, who lived in Nottingham, has been exposed as having worked as an undercover police officer. It had a photograph of a goateed man in a sort of furry Russian hat.
What did you think?
Well, I'll tell you one thing we thought was, how do we prove it?
Because if it was wrong and we published it, then, you know, you were defaming someone who could have been a genuine activist. So, I mean, it took about 2 or 3 months, actually, before we were comfortable with the idea of publishing that he was an undercover officer.
You mentioned earlier that this story had come from a post on Indie Media. So activists were clearly already investigating this themselves. To what extent did you work with them to try to bring these stories to light?
You know, throughout this whole process, everything that we did was in partnership with political activists who themselves were doing really important investigative work. So, you know, some of the advances in the investigations with respect to individual officers were activists on their own themselves. Other bits were The Guardian doing its work. And very often there was also collaboration between the two.
Over time, Rob and Paul confirmed that the activist known as Mark Stone, one of the environmental protest movement's most prolific organisers, had been leading a double life and was actually the undercover policeman Mark Kennedy. He'd become so embedded in his life as an activist that 200 people turned up to his 40th birthday as Mark Stone. He'd also had sexual relationships with several of the people he was spying on. By Sunday, the 9th of January, 2011, Paul and Rob were ready to publish, writing that Kennedy had infiltrated dozens of protest groups. Things quickly began to unravel.
The infiltration of the environmental protest movement here in Britain by an undercover police officer is being blamed tonight for the collapse of a major trial. Charges against 6 protesters were suddenly dropped today after questions were raised about the role of PC Mark Kennedy. Sporting long hair and tattoos, he'd been at the heart of direct action for 6 years.
Paul, how big was the reaction?
It caused a firestorm.
BBC News at 6 o'clock. Lawyers for 6 environmental protesters are calling for an inquiry into the use of undercover officers after one of the campaign group was unmasked as a police agent.
For 7 years, PC Mark Kennedy walked, talked and acted like an environmental protester.
He was a regular sight at many of the demonstrations, like this one at the Drax power station in North Yorkshire.
His case raises fundamental questions about policing protest and dissent in the UK.
This isn't the kind of thing you expect when you're talking about organising some sit-ins and some protests. And, you know, you don't think that at that kind of level of organisation there's going to be someone in the room who is a trusted activist who is actually secretly a police officer who's working against you.
I mean, people were stunned that the British police were putting undercover police officers in protest groups for several years at a time and seemingly either turning a blind eye or sanctioning them forming long-term sexual relationships with the people they were supposed to be spying on. I mean, Rob and I know that senior police officers were unaware that this was happening. It was a secret within a secret. There was an immense amount of interest in the Mark Kennedy story, who he was, what he'd been up to, what kind of impact did he have on the people he was spying on? But there was also, obviously, a massive question on everyone's mind. Are there others out there?
So how did the police respond?
Well, the police responded how they always respond, which is to try and say as little as possible. But they were also started to spin this line that Mark Kennedy was a rogue officer and he was just, you know, had got off on his own. But actually what had happened was is that he was only the last in the latest in a long line of undercover officers who had been sent to infiltrate political groups. And what the effect of the unmasking of Mark Kennedy was that suddenly it was like a dam breaking.
After Mark Kennedy was ousted, it was Lynn Watson.
She was a friend. I thought she was a friend. You suddenly understand that it wasn't a friendship and that you're being played, and you're being played in part of a kind of what is quite a dark, dark game.
And after Lynn Watson, it was Marco Jacobs.
Lynn Watson, Marco Jacobs, all of them are accused of having sexual relationships with activists.
And then Jim Boyling.
He was duping us all. Fundamentally, I think it was just sex on lots of levels, and to enhance his cover and as a perk of the job.
And Bob Lambert.
To friends in the animal rights movement, this was Bob Robinson, a loyal friend and committed activist. In fact, they had been duped. He was Bob Lambert, a police spy who had adopted a fake identity to spend 3 years living undercover. 20 years on, Lambert is a lecturer at St Andrews University. He has recently admitted to some failings during his undercover deployment, which saw him develop sexual relations with women, including one activist with whom he fathered a child.
And Mark Cassidy?
His name was Mark Cassidy. He began a sexual relationship with Alison. He moved into her house and was to live with her there for 4 years.
When he told me he was going to work, I suspect strongly he was going home.
To his wife and children?
To his wife and children. He's a very strong personality and, you know, I loved him very much. I'm sure they love him very much.
They just started falling like flies. And then we had this incredible breakthrough when a guy called Pete Francis got in touch with us.
I personally have stepped out of the shadows, come forward.
Peter Francis is the only undercover police officer who has spoken openly and in the public interest about what he did. He is the only undercover police officer who deserves the term whistleblower. Initially, you know, off the record, in a highly confidential way, and eventually in public, he had some bombshells.
The murder of Stephen Lawrence in 1993 was a watershed moment in British policing.
He revealed that police had monitored the campaign for justice of the Stephen Lawrence family.
The Metropolitan Police came under intense scrutiny. Francis was told to monitor the political campaign surrounding Lawrence's death.
Did you ever pick up anything about family members that you then passed back?
Yeah, there was rumours and conjecture that the family itself may have not have been sort of a loving, caring home, that was passed on about the family that could have been used, may have been used if they were really desperate to try to smear the family.
And he just gave us incredible insights into the way this whole operation had been working.
What did he tell you? What was the Special Demonstration Squad?
It was set up in 1968. It was a new tactic that the police wanted to introduce, basically because they had felt, the establishment had felt caught out by a demonstration that had happened in March 1968. An anti-Vietnam War demonstration.
3:45, 15,000 people begin their march on the American embassy. Their intention is to demonstrate and hand in an official note of protest about the war. They are determined the police will not stop them.
In essence, they were set up because, you know, in the late 60s, there was a lot of political unrest.
What began in 1968 as an effort to monitor what were then called subversives, continued for four decades and basically remained unchanged. The language changed. I mean, they started to call it, you know, surveillance of quote-unquote domestic extremists. But they were effectively the same types of people, people who were protesting, sometimes with civil disobedience, very rarely with any violence or serious criminality.
It's pretty extraordinary to live in a different character for 4 or 5 years. How on earth did they manage to live these double lives for so long?
Well, if you ask Peter Francis, he will say it becomes impossible to distinguish between your two separate identities. It's something that many of the undercover police officers really struggled with. You know, Pete compared it to method acting, that he would have to sort of get into this character over a lot of time. And one of the things that we discovered was that, you know, the difficulty, the psychological difficulties many of the police officers faced is partly what led to several of them, if you like, going rogue. You know, that's what arguably happened with Mark Kennedy. His deployment ended. I don't think he wanted to give up the life of Mark Stone, the activist. And he went back. You know, his officers, his superiors had told him to leave, and he went back as Mark Stone, but working for a private security company. But he had none of the apparatus that you need to be an undercover police officer, like a false passport, which had been taken off him. So Mark Kennedy was effectively, you know, living the life of Mark Stone, but without the support of the police officers. And that ultimately turned out to be his undoing. He went on holiday in Italy with his then girlfriend. She was looking for her sunglasses, put her hand in the glove compartment, found a passport. And it wasn't Mark Stone's passport. It was Mark Kennedy's passport. She'd never heard of anyone called Mark Kennedy. She looked at his phone and she found text messages from his children. He'd never mentioned he had children.
Coming up, Jessica finds out who Andy really was.
I just sat there for such a long time. I just sat there, just like looking at his picture. I didn't get a wink of sleep that night. I was up the entire night, just looking, trying to find anything I could on the internet and just looking at everything. And I think I was up the whole following day and the following night.
Okay, so you're looking at this image on Facebook in 2017. And it is this guy you dated 25 years ago. You thought his name was Andy Davey. And now you're being told he's a police officer called Andy Coles. How did you go about finding out more?
I went back to the friend that had directed me to that page. And I think I said, did you know that I was in a relationship with him? And he said, you know, well, yes, he did. And basically, they'd been looking for me. He said, oh, you know, there's something else. He's actually the Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner for Cambridgeshire and Peterborough. And he's also a Conservative councillor for Peterborough. He sent me a video.
I would like to therefore ask the candidate, Andy Coles, if he would like to come up to the table.
The video was him being sworn in as the Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner.
What do you think the role of the Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner should be? And what qualities can you offer which makes you suitable for this position?
I've had 30 years of service in the Met. I've worked in a huge number of different areas, both in court policing and within specialist roles.
It just sent shivers down my spine.
And I've dealt with some of them.
He had sort of quite a distinctive voice, softly spoken, but I suppose forceful.
So I do understand the policing business really well.
That just took me right back.
And you found out that he'd lied about, well, everything really, including his age, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. That was, that's the worst thing, I think, is to know that he was so old. And, you know, I mean, that still feels like I'm saying it as though I'm 19. But I remember what I was like at 19. And, you know, I would have said, you know, oh, he's so old, you know, that's gross. I thought he was 24. He was 32. I think that's given me the most difficulty to deal with, is because it changes everything. You know, where I think all these years I've written off the way that he sort of lunged at me to begin with as him being like a bit inexperienced, a bit socially awkward, making a bit of a hash of, you know, sort of approaching someone, just doing it really badly.
You felt sorry for him?
Yes, yeah. I sort of thinking, you know, well, he probably hasn't, you know, had many girlfriends and stuff and doesn't really know that kind of like, you don't do that. But now I have to look back at it and just think, no, he was a man in his 30s. You know, he was married. He'd been a police officer for 10 years. So he'd had all the experience of, you know, all the things that the police pick up about, you know, people's habits and how to spot certain things in certain people. You know, I was young, I was naive, I was inexperienced, I was awkward. he targeted and groomed me. There's no other way of looking at it.
Was he adopted?
No, not that we know of.
So how does it feel that he used that in a family situation with you?
That's quite a difficult thing to think about. It's sick. You know, I think there's got to be something wrong with these people. You can't use people's, you know, lives and experiences like that. You know, it's beyond cruel. I decided, no, you don't do this to people and get away with it.
And so Jessica contacted lawyers and then travelled to London, where she met The Guardian's Rob Evans, who was reporting on this and still uncovering shocking details years later. When Andy Cole's deployment ended in 1995, he wrote a document called the Tradecraft Manual, which was sort of a set of instructions for future undercover operatives, which is just an extraordinary document when you read it. It was a secret for a long time, but it's been released as part of the inquiry. One of the things that strikes me when I read that manual is the language Andy Coles uses when he's writing about the people the police are supposed to be infiltrating. It ranges from a sort of comically two-dimensional stereotype. For example, being a little untidy, smelly and rumpled is a natural state for many of the people in our target groups. Close associates may discern the smell of fresh clothing from the suburban washing line. To passages that show a pretty profound level of disdain, writing about anarchists, he says, "You will be expected to eat food you wouldn't put in your own bin. Worst of all, they smell disgusting in the summer months." I mean, none of this seems very professional for police officers who are surely supposed to investigate things with an open mind. Doesn't this show very clear preconceived ideas about what was happening?
I mean, what it shows is what they were thinking when they were talking to each other without any thought that this would be a document that would emerge into the public at some point. And it shows what they actually think, you know, rather than what they think that they should be saying. And it shows very, very clearly the culture within the unit at that time.
The SDS used to call themselves the Hairies, because many of these undercover police officers would have shaggy hair and beards and stuff. And they called the people they were spying on the Wearies, because they thought they were wearisome.
And what about the type of thing he got up to undercover? Did he mention them in the manual?
One bit that you see in the Tradecraft manual, you know, takes on a new significance when you know what actually happened and what Andy Coles actually did undercover. He talks about how to avoid sexual encounters, he talks about, and the paragraph begins, "While you may try to avoid any sexual encounter, there may come a time when your lack of interest may become suspicious." A bit redacted. "Options are fraught with difficulty, and you must make up your own mind about how to proceed. If you have no other option but to become involved with a weary, you should try to have fleeting, disastrous relationships with individuals who are not important to your sources of information. One cannot be involved with a weary in a relationship for any period of time without risking serious consequences."
Jessica, how did you feel when you read that?
It's quite disgusting the way that he speaks about it. I mean, I won't disagree with the disastrous. You know, I think, yes, looking back, it was a disastrous relationship. Part of me thinks that because it's, you know, there's this basically group of men that, you know, think they're sort of a little bit special, and you know, they've got all this power, and you know, they know that no one's going to know who they are, and whatever they do, whether they break the law, they're not going to be charged. You know, basically they're untouchable. And I think it's just gave them sort of the green light to go ahead and do whatever they wanted.
¶¶
Paul, this was such a huge intrusion. It had lifelong ramifications for the people being spied on. What was the justification? Did this technique result in evidence of serious crime, or at the very least, intelligence that might have prevented crime?
One of the things that makes this type of undercover policing different to normal undercover policing is that these officers weren't trying to gather evidence that would be used in a criminal prosecution against someone. You know, if you think of your conventional drug sting, you know, an undercover cop will go into a pub, buy some cocaine, have a recording device on them, and that evidence is used to put someone away. They could never disclose the evidence that they were obtaining in court, because if they did that, the secret would be up. Activists would know that police were going to these lengths to spy on them. So this was just intelligence.
What type of intelligence?
Huge files on activists. Some of the details are very intrusive, mind-numbing, and you wonder, what is the point of that? You had one undercover officer called Sandra who spent, you know, 18 months, 2 years infiltrating in the early 70s a branch of the Women's Liberation Front who were campaigning for things that are actually, you know, pretty mainstream nowadays. Abortion, contraception, nurseries. And, you know, if you looked at her report, she would be writing down, you know, such and such was going to go on a holiday. She would write down that the group was going to have a jumble sale and they were going to bake cakes to raise money. And all of this she would write down in great detail and report it back to her bosses, who would send it, in many cases, back to MI5.
One thing that strikes me about these stories is that a few of the police officers who have come to be exposed seem to have placed themselves in positions where you would think they might be vulnerable to being recognised by members of the public. Andy Coles took on the very public-facing role of Deputy Police and Crime Commissioner. And actually, the reason his story came to light is surreal. Details of his undercover deployment ended up in the autobiography of his celebrity brother, Reverend Richard Coles, the former frontman of the Communards, who became a priest and now presents Saturday Live.
Yes, a very good morning and welcome to Saturday Live, where we just want to give you the silvery king of daytime telly, Philip Schofield.
And you told us about Bob Lambert earlier, who fathered a child undercover. He took on a job as an academic and did speaking tours.
We'd like to talk to you about your infiltration of London Greenpeace and your abuse of female campaigners.
What are you saying, dog?
Which is why he was confronted by the people he deceived. Why would they have risked being recognised?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good question. I think that probably what happened is that they did this for so long and they were so successful at keeping it a secret that they forgot that they were just one exposure away from the whole pack of cards coming down. And they got sloppy. You're right, it is a bit odd, particularly with Bob Lambert, because he adopted a particularly public role. You know, he gave lectures, he went on TV. I think he may even have written some articles for The Guardian. The only difference in his appearance was that he'd grown a beard, and whilst he was undercover, he was clean shaven. There was always a possibility that he would be recognised, including by the mother of his child.
What did Andy Coles do after his identity was exposed?
Andy Coles, after he was exposed, resigned as the Deputy Police Commissioner for Cambridgeshire. He remains a Tory councillor in Peterborough, but he's actually said very little about the relationship, and he continues to deny it.
Jessica, you've described having a sexual relationship with a man who was 13 years older than you, unknowingly, who was married, and who was effectively doing this because of his job. When you think back to that as a woman now in your 40s, how do you process that?
It's very hard to look to look at it without thinking that, you know, basically it was, you know, it wasn't a consensual relationship. I didn't have informed consent. You know, I didn't know who he was. And the fact that he absolutely knew that had I known who he was, he wouldn't have got through the front door, you know, let alone sort of into, you know, into my bed. You know, I feel soiled, I suppose, by the whole thing. You know, it makes me feel, you know, quite disgusted, you know, and disgusting. I still almost feel a bit responsible that maybe I should have known, or I should have, there's all these things that I should have done that I wished I'd done. And, you know, I mean, I can't, they will drive me mad if I give in to thinking about that.
Do you wish you hadn't found out? How traumatic has this been for you?
It's, I think, the worst, yeah, the worst 4 years I can remember, to be honest. I suffered quite badly with depression after I found out, you know, it's been pretty awful. If I had the choice of knowing or not knowing, I would want to know. I wish, you know, with every part of me that this hadn't happened. I can't go, you know, I can't go back and change anything. It's just, you know, I've just got to keep sort of going, keep going forward. But yeah, it's, the whole thing is just, is a nightmare. You know, life is a complete nightmare.
Paul, you've spoken to so many women who have been through different versions of this experience. Hearing from Jessica, it must have been so traumatic for all of them.
I think it's fair to say that it has had an incredibly impactful effect on many women's lives. Their lives are not the same as they thought they were going to be. You know, there are women who had ideas about the lives they were going to live, they were going to have children, the person they were going to, you know, grow old with, and then that person just vanished, never to be seen again. That's painful enough. I mean, that's a massive trauma to deal with. And then years later, they discover that they were paid to spy on them. I mean, you know, there are, you know, you can hear these stories about undercover police officers deceiving women into relationships again and again and again. But it still doesn't stop you from being shocked. You know, we've been writing about it for 10 years, and I still think, what, that actually happened? As we were reporting these stories, one of the things that lots of people said was that they just read like fiction. It's like crime fiction, like a spy thriller. And one of the things that we found out actually was in Day of the Jackal, the novel by Frederick Forsyth. And it seemed stranger than fiction. It was that undercover police officers were stealing the identities of dead children and using them as their undercover identity.
That's tomorrow, in part two of the Spy Cop scandal. In this episode, you heard The Guardian's head of investigations, Paul Lewis, and investigative reporter Rob Evans, as well as Jessica, the name used by the woman who says she was in a sexual relationship with Andy Coles in the early 1990s when he was an undercover police officer. We went to Coles' lawyer about this episode, and he said, Mr. Coles intends to provide his evidence to the inquiry, and in the circumstances, it would be inappropriate to comment at this time. Previously, he has denied that he had an intimate relationship with Jessica in the 1990s, dismissing her claims as lurid. In February, a Scotland Yard investigation said it had uncovered credible evidence that an undercover officer deceived a 19-year-old woman into a long-term sexual relationship after Jessica made a complaint. Ruling in her favour, it said Coles would have faced a disciplinary hearing if he had not already retired from the Met Police. Jessica is taking legal action against the Met Police, who have told her that they are no longer contesting her legal action and will discuss compensation. Others who have been accused of acting as undercover officers have given different accounts of the past,
Mark Kennedy did speak out in an interview with The Guardian's Simon Hattonstone in the months after his role was revealed. Meanwhile, Rob and Paul continue to report tirelessly on this issue, particularly in light of the inquiry. Do read their excellent pieces at theguardian.com and check out the book they have written on all of this, Undercover, the True Story of Britain's Secret Police. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly with the help of Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with part two tomorrow.